For me, it was really interesting to try to get into the Norwegian DNA of aesthetics and light and sound and smells and food.
Nordic noir has been slashing its way through paperback novels and small screen adaptations, but it hasn't quite made its way to the big screen just yet. Is The Snowman the film to change that? From Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan, and this is The Cinema Show. Also ahead,
I discovered this book, The Lives of the Twins, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was funny, sexy, and it was an erotic thriller, and it was something I wanted to make for a long time as a film.
French filmmaker François Ozon unleashed his psychosexual thriller L'Amant Double on audiences at this week's London Film Festival. He'll tell us how a novel by Joyce Carol Oates inspired his absurdly twisted tale. And
it's not about technology or sci-fi, it's basically about how we live our lives and what they're made up of, particularly memory.
She began her career starring opposite James Dean in 1955's East of Eden. Now, 86-year-old Lois Smith is playing opposite John Hamm in the cleverly touching science fiction tale, Marjorie Prime. That's all ahead on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Tell me.
I think it's the falling snow that sets the killer off.
Then who does he leave the snowman for? Building snowmen, cutting things up into little pieces. That's what a child does to establish order.
A call just came in. There's another missing woman.
Norwegian author Jo Nesbø's series of chilly Harry Hole thrillers make their first leap to the screen with The Snowman, a very stylish adaptation from Swedish filmmaker Thomas Elfredson. Snowmannen is actually the seventh book in the series, charting the troubled career of Oslo's brilliant detective, played here by the excellent Michael Fassbender. And no one appears to be quite sure why the story starts here. The film picks things up during Harry Hole's hunt for Norway's first serial killer. He's struggling under the weight of an over-reliance on alcohol that might explain why his only meaningful connection comes from a family that seems to have moved on since he began living alone in his chilly warehouse conversion. Fans of the books may feel disoriented by the world Alfredson has crafted. It's a feast for the eyes. The falling snow, modern urban landscapes, and cool homes all coalesce into a carefully constructed mood. But the film takes a few quite dramatic detours from the original text, and with its smorgasbord of international accents, including an Irishman in the role of Norway's greatest detective, this is hardly a setting rooted in cold, harsh reality. Although it's not really trying to either. There's already enough gritty crime out there. Alfredson, he's more concerned with the cold brutality that can arise when human nature loses touch with human relationships. You might say Harry Hole is a man without a family, and yet he's actually surrounded by one. But he'll need to travel a very dangerous path and make some gruesome discoveries before he discovers the true emotional value of those who've become his family. Thomas Elfredson's previous credits include the vampire thriller Let the Right One In and the espionage caper Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. He's also assembled an extraordinary cast to inhabit his stylized vision of Oslo. In addition to Michael Fassbender, there's Rebecca Ferguson, Chloe Sevigny, J.K. Simmons, and in a small but important role, Val Kilmer. But of course, the first things anyone will notice about The Snowman are the crisp, cool visuals. I sat down with Thomas to ask how his color palette came together.
I try to avoid films in general. I don't watch a lot of films, and especially from a professional point of view, I try to find inspiration from other things. But I'm Swedish, and the film is set in Norway, and for me it was what's typically Norwegian and what is their palette and how does things look there. And even if foreigners or people from the rest of the world think that the Scandinavian countries are the same thing, it's for us Swedes, Norway is, we don't know exactly how things look or what's typically Norwegian. It's as exotic as it might be for you. So for me, it was really interesting to try to get into the Norwegian DNA of aesthetics and light and sound and smells and food and what have you.
For a Swedish filmmaker, then, what are the steps that you take to try and get into that sort of mindset? Because I think another interesting factor about the film is that it has a very interesting sense of place. And of course, the city of Oslo runs very, very rich through all of the books as well. How did you get yourself into the sort of palette where you felt comfortable creating your image on the screen?
Well, I spend a lot of time just walking. So I went there many, many times just walking around. Of course, looking at their art is very important. So, for instance, we chose, me and Dion Beebe, who's the cinematographer, we chose a painting that was like, this is how snow should look like. This is the angles of light, and these are the main colors we're working with, which is an Edvard Munch painting, the famous Norwegian painter. Also, music is something very important that I try to listen to, the Norwegian music from old traditional but also contemporary music. It helps you a lot.
Interestingly, with the cast that you've assembled, an absolutely fantastic cast with so many exceptionally talented people, was it something, a decision that you made from the outset to try and infuse as many different accents as possible? Because I did find that even though it is a film set in Norway, it's based on Norwegian books, but it's also completely free of any Norwegian, the language. Is that something that you made? Is that a decision you made from the outset?
It's quite complicated to do a film in the English language, but I suppose it's a very common problem or a tricky thing to make working on film, is to make it as if it's, you're not supposed to be thinking about it. You know, the most ridiculous examples is the when you have films where you're in France and people are talking like this. But it's I found it, it was a lot about avoiding signs, avoiding names that would be too alien, but you couldn't, you know, totally avoid it either. So it was to create this, the a mixture. For instance, in Norwegian, police, the word for police is politi, which an Englishman would read politi, which would be something very weird to have cars with politi on it, even if you would sort of understand what it would mean. So the solution would be not to write police, but to not have text on a police car. So all the police cars in the film has no text on it. Or the main character's name is Harry Hole, which is something you could, even if it's slightly weird, it's a quite normal name. And also avoiding names on addresses or particular places that would sort of push the audience out of the fiction. So it's trickier than you might think, but hopefully it feels as if we're in a foreign place, but it's not too foreign so that you're thinking about it too much.
I thought that was one of the most refreshing parts of the film, actually, because I do find that often films get a little bit, well, maybe not so much films, but viewers often get a little bit too hung up on the details of where exactly a film is. Why aren't they speaking with this correct language? Or why is his accent a little bit funny? But that's something that I think we've manufactured in recent years, because if you go back to some quite a lot older films, quite often Hollywood films would be set in Budapest, even if the film was made completely on the old MGM lot, for instance. Do you think that maybe that is something that audiences should be a little bit more used to these days?
I don't know, but I think it's the sum of the details. It's the sum of the details that makes it. It's if you have a clear idea of what the palette is and what how things sound or how people sound, or, you know, for instance, silence is a very important thing in Scandinavia, also in the interaction between people. So if I would ask you a question and you're not answering, that is also an answer, you know. And using silence is very effective on film. So you could use that a lot. And I don't think people will think about it actively watching this, but they will. It'll be an ingredient that it would make it feel slightly different in a good way, because it's something, there's so much content around these days pouring out of every hole. I think audiences are very motivated to look at stuff that is set in unexpected places. We have an opening in Oslo next week, so it's going to be very interesting to hear what they feel.
Thomas Alfredsen, director of the tense new thriller, The Snowman, out in cinemas this week. Still to come, we'll sit down with the 86-year-old actress Lois Smith to discuss her career that began opposite James Dean way back in 1955 and her latest starring role opposite John Hamm. But first, a look at what else London's film folk have been whispering about this week. The London Film Festival is in full swing this week in the city's Piccadilly Circus. It's abuzz with industry folk rushing from one screening to the next. The star of the festival so far is without doubt Luca Guadagnino's Call Me By Your Name, a love story between 17-year-old Elio, played by Timothy Chalamet, and his romance with Oliver, an older visitor to his family's house in Italy, played by Armie Hammer. Originally, however, the film was to have been directed by James Ivory. His previous credits include A Room with a View in 1985 and Morris in 1987, and they helped challenge ideas of male nudity and gay relationships on the screen. But he was left a little disappointed by the careful approach employed in Call Me By Your Name, telling Variety that American audiences had prevailed and that nobody seems to care that much or be shocked about a totally naked woman. It's the men. This is something that must be so deeply cultural that one should ask, why? Indeed, he may have a point. This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned. Film festivals are, of course, an excellent way to step outside your usual cinema diet and sample something completely different. They're also the perfect place to catch a glimpse of releases to watch out for over the coming months. One film that's sure to make waves is Beach Rats. Many are hoping that, following the victory of Moonlight at the Academy Awards and the fanfare, of course, surrounding Call Me By Your Name, gay cinema might be on the brink of a turning point. Eliza Hittman has crafted something a little different, though. Far from the usual coming-out story, it focuses on a young, good-looking guy living in Brooklyn who spends his days smoking and walking around town shirtless while secretly hunting for hookups at night. I asked Eliza how the concept came together.
I am very interested in sort of sexuality and relationship to sort of where you're from and how you sort of develop, you know, that identity and that part of yourself. And I made another film in 2013 called It Felt Like Love, which deals very much with a 14-year-old girl and the sort of pressure that she feels to sexualize herself before anybody perceives her as being sort of a sexual creature, I guess, or a woman for that matter. And, you know, through sort of shooting that film, I cast a lot of like guys from a certain neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I was really interested in making a film about those guys in that neighborhood. And those guys are called beach rats. And while we were shooting the film, we noticed that there was also a lot of cruising happening in the same area where these like sort of tough macho kind of junky kids were hanging out. And I was thinking a lot about like the kind of guys who are hanging out on those beaches at night, men, and then these sort of late teens kids who are hanging out on the beaches during the day, and really conceived the film around a character who was sort of caught between these two worlds.
Another film stirring things up, though for entirely different reasons, is Francois Ozon's sensational psychosexual thriller, L'Amant Double. This is a film that defies a one-line description. Dark fetishes, identical twins, mystifying fantasy sequences, and lots of nudity. And it all came from a book written under a pseudonym by Joyce Carol Oates.
Actually, I'm a big fan of Joyce Carol Oates, and I've read many of her books, and she's a graphoman. She has written so many books, I think more than 100 books. And one day, reading a review about, I learned that she had a pseudonym, and she was used to writing some books with the pseudonym of Rosamund Smith. And so I was very curious to know that she had two names and what kind of book she was writing under a pseudonym. And I discovered this book, The Lives of the Twins, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was funny, sexy, and it was an erotic thriller. And it was something I wanted to make for a long time as a film. So I worked on it, and I made an adaptation, and I realized already the American made an adaptation in the 80s on television with Isabella Rossellini and Aidan Quinn. And I saw the film and it was terrible. So I said, it's easy to make better.
Well, attracting its share of attention at the festival also is Ingrid Goes West, director Matt Spicer's sharp and witty jab at the age of Instagram. It took a screenplay award when it premiered at Sundance earlier this year, and while it might be set firmly in a version of California that's as vacuous as it is sun-soaked, its genius really lies in its superb understanding of character.
Dave, my co-writer, and I, we were having lunch in Los Angeles, and he's a screenwriter too, and it was just a friendly kind of lunch, and we just started talking about social media and specifically Instagram, and how we both have this kind of love-hate relationship with it, that we both use it a lot and we're fans of the app, but it tends to dredge up the darker sides of ourselves that maybe we wouldn't want to admit exist, you know, our sort of insecurities and things where we're looking at, you know, what people post and thinking, oh, are we not going on enough vacations, or are we not wearing cool enough clothes, or, you know, like things like that. And so I think Ingrid kind of became this vessel for us to pour all of our conflicting feelings about social media and Instagram into.
We'll hear from Matt Spicer, Eliza Hittman, and Francois Ozon as their films hit theaters over the coming weeks. Up next, from James Dean to John Hamm, we'll look at the remarkable career of Lois Smith as her new film, Marjorie Prime, arrives in theaters. As if delivered by lightning, the fine folk at MUBI are presenting lucky subscribers this week with Spell Reel, straight from the London Film Festival's Experimenta section. This strange cinematic journey is the work of Portuguese artist Felipe César and is sure to challenge ideas of what makes a movie. There's also the MUBI exclusive Almost Heaven, fresh from this year's Berlin Film Festival. Carol Salter's documentary is an unusual coming-of-age tale, following a young woman's introduction to her new job as a mortician in China. And the retrospective of Pablo Larraín's work continues with the 2012 film No, featuring the sensational Gael Garcia Bernal. MUBI is the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Sample a month for free by heading to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. It was way back in 1954 when a young Lois Smith arrived on the set of East of Eden for a screen test with James Dean. This would be the big screen break for both of them, and while everyone was feeling quite confident about the film's prospects of success, there was no way of predicting the legend it would become. Now aged 86, Lois is once again on the big screen, this time opposite Mad Men star John Hamm in the extraordinary new science fiction drama Marjorie Prime. Based upon the Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Jordan Harrison, the film tells the story of a woman's decision to employ a service that offers to bring back a loved one in the form of a hologram. In Marjorie's case, she's opted to resurrect her late husband, played as he appeared decades earlier by John Hamm. But before it will operate correctly, the hologram must be programmed with a series of memories, raising questions of what really matters more, the truth of a memory or how it makes us feel. I asked Lois how a story rooted in strange new technology might have struck her when she first recorded that screen test decades ago.
You wouldn't think about it, I guess. No, it wouldn't occur to you that fairly soon there would be an artificial intelligence companion possible. One of the things I loved was the element of surprise, which is something I care very much about when I'm either watching or performing in the theater or film. The script is full of it, it seems to me. You haven't been there before. You don't really quite know what you're seeing or what's next. But it's basically not about technology or sci-fi. It's basically about how we live our lives and what they're made up of, particularly memory. Marjorie Prime is having trouble with her memory. And so the Prime, which is the artificial intelligence companion played by John Hamm, is both a spur to memory, a memory in a way himself, as a younger version of the husband who's no longer living. But the main thing is always the humanity of it, not the technology of it. In my opinion, I think it's true.
Some of the stories that sprung to mind when I looked at this film was, I know people have made comparisons to a couple of episodes of Black Mirror.
I've heard that. I haven't seen them myself, but I heard that.
Well, yes. Worth a watch, indeed. And there's also the Spike Jonze film, Her.
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite films, in fact. The similarities I found was that you can read a synopsis of these films and you might look at the surface details and think, what a strange idea. Mm. And then when you watch the film and when you get involved in the story, it's really, as you say, the emotions that you really connect with. Was that something that stuck out to you when you first read the script for this? Or did it take a while? Did you have to read it a few times in order to really understand what was going on?
No, it always seemed to me so clearly about human beings and the way we live our lives and the emotions. Yes, it's really about emotional life. That seemed obvious. The surprise element is that you didn't quite know what happened next. That's exciting. Yeah.
I think for a lot of people today, we can't imagine not being on Facebook, for instance.
And I'm not on Facebook, never have been, never wished to be. So I'm not the person you're speaking about, though most of my fellows are, I understand that.
And even though Facebook really hasn't been around for very long at all, and I think a lot of young people today particularly couldn't imagine a world without
social
media. Couldn't
imagine. Isn't that true? Yes, yes.
Essentially, I think the creation that John Hamm is playing in Marjorie Prime, to me, he feels like a sort of fictional interpretation of the role that social media can play. Because in effect, for a lot of people, social media does mimic that feeling of having company.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yes. Yes, yes.
So for you, as you just say, you're not on social media.
No.
What are your views on the concept of social media from what you understand about it? How do you feel about the role that social media is playing in today's culture?
Well, it seems to me very complicated just from what I read about it lately, especially in my country with, oh my goodness. But I guess for myself, I think, well, where do they find the time? I'm fairly inept, I think, at modern technology. But it's hard for me to imagine living without email, living without the phone. It took me a while to want one, but now that I have one, oh my goodness, what do you do without it? But those things take up time, just that. And then I think, where do all of these people, almost everybody except me and a few people I know, find the time? Because it takes a lot of time to be online. I don't get it. I don't know how they do it. Now, I think it may be that I don't use my time terribly well or quickly, but I think I also treasure the slowness of my life in a way, that is the lack of being constantly at it, you know?
I think for a lot of people, social media, it's a way for people to record their memories as well. For you, because obviously Marjorie Prime is very much about the concept of memories.
Absolutely.
And how we remember things and how sometimes the chronological order of those memories isn't really what's important.
I'm aware of how much I don't remember, I think, because I've been around for a long time. And sometimes things seem very long ago, because they are, you know. On the other hand, there's one part of the brain that brings it all together so that it's maybe not long ago at all. Maybe it's all at once. Someone asked me recently about learning lines, but I think that's a really different part of the brain, you know. I don't think learning lines, which is something I do still, maybe not as fast as I used to be, but not a problem. But that's different from remembering what happened, you know, 40, 60 years ago.
What were your impressions when you decided to inhabit the role that you play in this story? Was there a process you went through to try and relate to the way that your character was maybe not coping so well with the memories that she had, and she needed something else? Memories weren't enough for her. She wanted some sort of physical embodiment of her memories. How did you get into the character of someone who felt that emotional void and wanted something more?
I think the author had sort of taken care of it. It really feels to me like the writing has spelled it all out. In terms of performing it, one of the things I remember early on and that I've always treasured is the sense that Marjorie is up for the adventure. While she's talking to Walter Prime, she's enjoying it, aware of what it is, though there are times when this companion becomes near enough to the memory he's embodying, as it were, that it becomes a companion on that level. But the fact of the enjoyment of it is in a certain way separate from the memory loss part of it. I think I've always felt that Marjorie loved life, and this was one aspect of that for her, rather than a sadness of making up for something lost.
You're still too old for me.
We'll grow old together. I'll just do that a little sooner than you. After a while, it won't really matter.
Lois Smith, star of the lovely new film Marjorie Prime, which is out in theatres now. The film also stars John Hamm, Gina Davis, and Tim Robbins, and it took the Sloan Feature Film Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And that's all for this week. Today's show was edited and mixed by Christy Evans and researched by Yulin Goffin. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.